Yes, the Soul Genome, Science and Reincarnation. We'll be back with Paul Von Ward in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Paul Von Ward, his work, The Soul Genome. Paul, let's talk about the children for a moment and some of their incredible cases. You mentioned Carol Bowman and her work with the young boy up there in Chicago who believes that he was a World War II pilot. It's uncanny because everything he talked about, he couldn't have picked up from TV or anything like that. He even knew things, names. It was just an incredible. How many children experience memory like that?
Well, it's hard to tell because we don't have any way of reporting. What we hear are, you know, those extraordinary cases. But what I'm suggesting from the research that I think a number of us are involved in is that all children have some indications of and say things that they shouldn't know about, that they have had no way of learning. And even things that may sound sort of normal, like one little three-year-old girl said to her parents, they were trying to get her to eat a hot dog, and she said, "I don't want to eat a hot dog." She said, "I ate hot dogs when I was a boy, but I'm not eating them now." Well, we just laughed, you know. But when you put all of these examples together, you hear many, many things that indicate some kind of knowledge about themselves, past experiences that we haven't, where did they pick it up from? I have a couple of cases of world-renowned physicians, one a plastic surgeon, one a neurosurgeon. When they were 3 and 4, they were talking about things to do with medicine, with being a physician. Even one of them mentioned being a surgeon. And that one happened to go on at age 5 and was found doing surgery on the little dead kittens that her cat brought to her.
Oh, my gosh.
And when I was speaking to a group recently, and she was in the audience, and she acknowledged that she was there and said, "Paul, I want to tell you, I was doing that, and when I got into surgery and medical school 15 years later," she was a precocious person in medical school, the youngest certified plastic surgeon in the country, she said, "I went into the surgery, and I had absolutely no problem with knowing what to do." And, you know, we have these kinds of examples where people have either declared something that they feel they know, that they consider they know, and there's no way that there was no parental influence, there was no cultural input into that sort of knowing. So what I'm suggesting is that what we are picking up on in the public now, there's a little boy in Scotland, for example, similar to the young boy that you just spoke about, who might have been a pilot in World War II, he remembered enough things about another place, an island, that could be verified. But his mother, picked up on it and started making notes. And what we're suggesting that people do is they begin to make notes of these things, and then let's check them out later on. I'm working on a case in a small town. It's an anonymous case because the family doesn't want friends and neighbors to know about it.
And if it's a small town, the world out there will know about it, right?
Absolutely. So we're keeping it anonymous, but this is a set of twins who are exhibiting physical mannerisms and behaviors exactly like their great-grandfather and the great-grandfather's brother. And this was noticed by their grandmother, who is in the middle of this, you know, family tree and could see both ends of it.
How often, and again, a lot of this is speculation, Paul, so, you know, I'm throwing these questions at you and there's not a lot of basis where you can pull from your answers. I understand that. But how often do you think these reincarnation cases are directly related to dead family members as opposed to just some obscure other person?
I don't know what that is, but what I'm finding is that there are definitely two categories. One is where you have alleged reincarnation in the phylogenetic tree, that is, in the family tree, so that you could argue that, well, the genes, that is, the physical DNA, somehow passed this on forward. But I would say that that is a minority of the cases, and the larger number of cases, there is no connection with the phylogenetic tree. In other words, it has to be, when we talked about the soul genome earlier, it has to be independent of the family tree itself, because we have so many cases where the physical features are more like the past life that has no link to the current family tree than that person's resemblances to their own parents and their own siblings. And it's not just physical features, it's also the kind of person, the sense of self, the talents, the background, the aspirations. In other words, I suspect among people listening here, you would have a large percentage of people who said, why did I come in this family? I don't belong in this family. I don't feel like this is my family. Because the differences at a very early age are so significant that the child knows it and the other family members know it. I talked to one case when I was talking to the members of the larger family about the possible reincarnation case of this person in the family and explaining, you know, the personality differences and so forth. And so one of the sisters spoke up, well, that explains it. I knew you were always different from us because they had always thought that the person in the family, in fact, I think there were rumors about maybe it was, you know, not biologically a part of the family. But that person was a biological part of the family, but was not a soul genome part of the family. And so we've got these two categories, and I can't give you a percentage or anything.
I understand.
Know. But it happens both. In traditional societies, there have been reports of many, many reincarnations within the families where they have even predicted, you know, that they would be reborn in that family. And in some cases, they had markings put on the dying person, a mark on the arm or someplace on the back, to see if they could see a mark when the grandson was born. And sure enough, there was a birthmark in that spot. So that's used as sort of indication of the validation of this ability to predict that you will come back in the family.
When I had Dr. Bruce Goldberg on the program, and he's a hypnotherapist, I asked him if he believes that the people who are reincarnated tend to live with, migrate toward other people that they might have lived with in a past life. So if you have a handful of close family members and friends, that he believes there's a pretty good likelihood that you were all together in a past life and then a past life. And I find that to be remarkable, Paul.
Well, I found that same circumstance in many, many cases. Once again, I don't know what percentage, but I do have a sense that we use the term soul cohort. In other words, groups of souls who are living together, working together, either professionally or personally connected somewhere or the other, who do tend to gravitate, even though they're born in different parts of the country or different parts of the world, over time they seem to find themselves to each other, to be close to one another. Now, we can, you know, if I want to put on my skeptic's hat and say, well, you know, that's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. We describe that phenomenon because we feel that we've discovered it there, and we are ignoring all of the other exceptions to that rule. So, once again, I don't know that that's a universal principle of reincarnation, but it does seem to occur. And what's interesting, and one of the things when I, because I'm particularly concerned from my psychology training to look at this from a developmental point of view. And so I'm particularly interested in comparing not only the characteristics of the past life and the present life, but I'm interested in comparing the interactions of people in that previous period. Let's take, say, a group of people who were in the United States involved in the era of our revolution and the beginning of our country. And they all had their interrelationships that are well documented historically. And there are a few people today who believe that they are the reincarnations of some of those people. Right. And what I've made a point of doing is studying their interactions to see whether they exhibit the same patterns of interpersonal behavior in this lifetime as they did in the past lifetime. And let me tell you, it is uncanny. You would think we would make a lot of progress, but evolution in terms of reincarnation is like evolution everywhere else. It's slow. It takes its time. Because they're having the same issues today they had 200 years ago.
So true. Is there anything that ever crosses your mind that gives you the possible doubt in your own belief system that reincarnation does not happen? Do you ever doubt that?
Yeah. One of the things that's happening after I've published the book and we have the website up inviting people to give us their comments and so forth. I have many cases now coming to me where some of the same effects that we are documenting for the basis of a reincarnation case seem to have occurred in other people, that is, memories or knowledge as a result of some traumatic experience, say a near-death experience, or a physical injury. In other words, something that happened that seemed to cause the conscious state of the person to have a dramatic shift. And so then they're picking up the same kind of knowledge and information that we've documented as being evidence of reincarnation. And I'm beginning to collect these. Because there are people who say there's an alternative explanation for all of this. I mentioned Jeffrey Mishlov earlier on, a psychologist, philosopher, wonderful colleague, studies all this paranormal material. But he believes that it's sort of an archetype phenomenon, you know, where we tap into an energy field of that person from the past, and we resonate with it, and it affects our behavior. And
pick up memory for some reason.
Pick up some memories and so on. Irvin Laszlo, for example, is a philosopher looking at integrating the new science into a worldview, a very erudite, solid scholar. And he believes that this evidence that we're talking about for reincarnation comes from individuals simply tapping into the Akashic records or the new sphere, or the, you know, whatever that collective unconscious is that seems to be the repository of all thoughts and so on.
Well, if you do tap into memory of past lives, isn't it almost like living that life anyway? Isn't that what memory is all about? I mean, you know, if they ever clone us and take our memory and download it into a chip and put it back into the new body, that becomes us, basically, doesn't it? With our outside of the soul, but in terms of memory.
Well, in terms of memory, yes. But that's why I'm trying to, and looking at this sort of psychophysical holographic model, I'm trying to keep memory, that is specific memories of events and details and times and places and that sort of thing. In other words, specific details of memory. I'm trying to keep that in one category, and along parallel with it, though, is a way of thinking. And I call this the cerebrotype or the mental factor. And what we've done is compare the writing, compare the creative work done by the past life and the present life, And we don't have, you know, the same specific details, but what we have are the patterns of thinking. Now, in the book, I talk about several of these cases, but one of them, for example, is an anonymous case of possible reincarnation of James Madison. Well, James Madison is the father of the Constitution and the fourth president of the United States, and he, you know, wrote all the stuff about the founding of the formulation of the Constitution and the convention that produced that. He has a copious amount of written material. Well, the guy today also has written a lot, and what we've done is analyze not the specific ideas which you might get in if you had memory, but how those ideas were put together. How did the mind work? How did the brain work? And so we see these patterns carried over. So, see, for me, that is more an indication of the fundamental nature of this soul genome, because it involves not just the details of specific memories, although there are a lot of coincidences in that area. You have this, literally, the mind profile, and you have the same interpersonal profile, the way the people in the previous life and the present life handle situations, handle relationships, and so on. So to me, that sort of trumps the notion that just it's a process of accidentally picking up memories out of the new sphere or the archetype somewhere.
It gets back, though, Paul, to the design.
That's right.
The truly incredible design. Now, if reincarnation exists, what's its purpose, in your opinion?
In my opinion, and I'm glad you got back to this point, because we talked about evolution and intelligent design a little bit earlier, because I think here what I'm about to say can satisfy both the evolutionary Big Bang theorist and the intelligent design theorist.
All right.
Because I think reincarnation is the way the universe preserves the evolution of consciousness from generation to generation and builds on generation after generation. From an evolutionary point of view, if the universe had not started with reincarnation as one of its ingredients at the beginning, it would have had to evolve it in order to take advantage of the learning of all the species in the universe.
It's all a learning process, isn't
it? It's an all learning. And this is so the soul genome is really just the flow of consciousness having an experience in a particular lifetime and a set of circumstances, and there is learning that takes place, because in my model of the self-learning universe, the whole universe is evolving towards greater complexity. Individual parts of it, including humans and the soul genomes of human, they are all experimenting, adapting, learning, and passing it on. And the way we pass change on in terms of the physical DNA influences is adaptation, mutation, passing it on to the next generation. Consciousness works the same way. We are learning, adapting, experimenting, and we carry it forward. And we carry forward a legacy, and in each lifetime it is worked on, and however we learn and experience life shapes, see, not just the memories, but shapes that set of factors that I call the mental one, the emotional one, the interpersonal one, and the creative one. So even if we don't have a full set of detailed memories about a previous life, we have that inner core, the really the basics of our personality.
Paul, when we come right back, let's talk about the reincarnation experiment and also mention again those four personality traits that you were talking about earlier. Well, tomorrow on Coast to Coast AM, our tentative first hour guest will be none other than singer and actress Debbie Reynolds. For those of you who just cherish Debbie's work, that should be a treat for you. And then later on in the program, our special guest will be David Icke. He's here in Los Angeles, and we'll have him on, and he'll talk about some of the incredible things he's done over the years in research. When we come back, it'll be Paul Von Ward. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Paul about reincarnation on Coast to Coast AM. Paul, let's review a little bit before we get into, of course, the experiment, the reincarnation experiment, what you're doing in that arena. These four personality types you compare past lives with people in your book, let's talk about them again. What are they?
Okay. The first one is what I call the cerebrotype. I mean, that's make it analogous to the genotype, which deals with the physical factors. The mental deals with the way we handle information, how we analyze, synthesize, take in, and evaluate, and use information. This is really a set of patterns about how our mind works. And psychologists have known for decades now that we can differentiate among people on these different factors, the mental, the emotional, and the interpersonal. You know, there are all kinds of popular tests out there that you can take to see whether you are an intuitive type or a thinking type and all those things. What I've done for the purposes of our research is I have culled from a large body of psychological research on personality factors to create some rating scales for these four areas. And in fact, Jim Tucker at University of Virginia made some input on that process when we were developing them from the child psychiatrist point of view, because we want to look at factors that are identifiable at a very young age. So we look at the mental profile, how we handle things. So that's one area. And that's what I was referring to earlier when I was talking about you can evaluate a past life if you have any information about their writing, the way other people talked about them, the way other people described them, and so on. So you use this sort of surrogate approach, but you can still come up with a good profile.
Okay.
Also, in terms of our what we call the ego type, that is our, you might say, the default emotional state. In other words, when things are going normally or over time, are we more manic? Are we more depressive? Are we more warm? Are we more cool and detached? And so there's a variety of scales that we evaluate people on in that area. So the third one is then the persona type or the interpersonal profile. And this is you know, the thing of being extroverted, introverted, and those kinds of factors. We have a small scale of five factors that we rate people on those to come up with a interpersonal style, if you please. And then the last one is to look at what the person does with their time in a creative way when they have the freedom to do it. A lot of us have to work on jobs that, you know, are not what we want to do. We work on that job to earn our living and so on. But if you look at what people actually do when they have the opportunity to express their creative interest, and of course people in professions and so on are more likely to be able to do that, our artists or musicians and so on. But we look at that and we use, once again, really several decades of psychological research to come up with the patterns that we're measuring. And we use six different categories that came out of something known in the psychological world as the Holland Codes. These are the areas of research that we all remember taking little tests in high school or college and having the counselor tell us, oh, well, you'll be better if you're in this vocation or that vocation. Well, there's something very solid about this kind of information because it's based on decades of research in the field of psychology and in education. So we've been able to distill those four factors down to get a picture of the present personality and the past personality and compare them. And what we find is that the most robust of these cases, that is the ones that look like they're real cases of reincarnation, if, with our caveat, it is real, and we can distinguish between cases by, for example, I have, this is something that, that Jim Tucker and I've talked about. You know, we've each had a number of people coming up saying, I'm the reincarnation of Thomas Jefferson. And so what this model that I'm using here allows us to do is to evaluate Thomas Jefferson on all of these genotype, cerebral type, persona type, performer type, et cetera, and these six people. And lo and behold, these methods of comparison differentiate among all these people. And, you know, we come up with one that is, if there is the reincarnation of Thomas Jefferson at this point in time, it is much more likely to be this person than these other people who all claim, you know, having had memories or experiences or what have you. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to have some way of assessing the similarities between lifetimes that we think comprise an integral personality. And we can't say for sure this person is the reincarnation of the same soul that was in that person 200 years ago. But we can say that if that soul genome that was in this person 200 years ago is reincarnated today, the statistical probability is very high that this person is the recipient of that soul genome. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And also now the big question for me with reincarnation, because since I was a young boy, I always believed, and this is very strange, I mean, a kid of 11 or 12 years old thinking of reincarnation, that just doesn't happen, does it? In terms of the belief system, not right. Who I was. But I've always believed that reincarnation was an act of perfection, which means you keep reincarnating until your soul becomes heavenly or perfect. Mm-hmm. And then you stop at a certain level. You get to a high level. You don't have to come back anymore. Is that the case?
Well, that's the Buddhist tradition, you know. That is the most ancient concept, and actually that same concept was prevalent in the time of Plato. So for several thousand years we had that sense, and there are a number of metaphysical writers who suggest that this is the case, that extra-dimensional beings that communicate with humans as, you know, as guides or spirits, speaking through channels and so on. This information is consistent with that. My scientific model can't answer that question, but it can answer the question that if the process that we're looking at in terms of the data, it is a process of evolution. Now, people say, oh, well, why aren't we getting better, or why do we still have the problems in society we have, and so on. The point is, you have to look at this with a very big lens, and you measure progress from lifetime to lifetime in rather small increments from, you know, a one lifetime perspective. But you, when you look at these lives, you do see progress. You do see things changing and evolving. And that takes us back to what we were saying earlier on. Reincarnation is the evolution of consciousness in this four-dimensional time and space universe in which we live. And it's not incompatible with that to think that when a particular soul evolves to the point where, you know, you've sort of experienced all the major varieties of human situations, and you've learned how to adapt and progress and surmount the challenges that you've had, that it doesn't, there's nothing else to learn in this particular part of the universe. And so that's not, my research is not incompatible with that notion. And in fact, that makes some logical sense to me. But my model doesn't go there.
All right, now tell me about the reincarnation experiment.
Well, this is just a way to involve the public in what we're doing. And when I say we, I started this project several years ago myself doing this meta-analysis that I talked about. But as I went along, I collected a number of people who wanted to be involved in one way or the other, either because they had interest in their own reincarnation cases and got involved, or because they were just intellectually curious about how it works. So a number of us have been developing new cases, developing the methodology, developing the measuring techniques that I talked about earlier on for the faces and the physical types and so on, developing these scales. And we have a website set up called the Reincarnation Experiment. And what it does is it gives people who log on an overview of the project, what our purpose is, and, you know, what some of the issues are. We're not trying to answer the big questions like the one you mentioned, but we're trying to take whatever tangible empirical evidence that we can find and put it into some sort of rational evaluation process. So that's explained on the website. And then another section...
But it's great for people to get involved with that.
See, my point about this whole project is that if what we're discovering is validated over time with other researchers and other people getting involved, if it's validated, it's going to change the way we think about ourselves and the way we think about society. Because it's not something that is extra-dimensional. It's not something that is partial. It is an inherent part of our being, our beingness, who we are, what we are. So what I've seen as people have gotten involved in evaluating their own evidence for past life influences, then it becomes real to them. And they can no longer think about themselves, you know, in the same way that they did before. So what we've suggested in the second part of this website is we have a section called Past Life Clues. In other words, you said, well, everybody doesn't have memories, or we may have had them, but we've forgotten them. That's true. But we have one of our colleagues, a woman in England, actually, Karen Holloway, who has put together a notebook for us to help us look at our own lives in a variety of ways, covering all these areas that I've been talking about and making notes. And a person begins to get a sense of what their past life legacy probably was. It doesn't matter what the name of that person was, or it doesn't matter, you know, whether that can be eventually identified or not. There is then the sense of, this is my past life legacy. And then there are ways that you can go about, tracing and possibly finding the past life. Many people have done that, either through intuition, having a sense, affinity with some personality or some particular historical era. Some people get some clues from psychics, or many people use regression therapy, and those are clues. You see, when you tap into this unconscious realm, you don't have the whole story and you don't have the whole picture, but you get clues that may lead you to the identification of a previous lifetime. In the book, Soul Genome, I've got several cases there where individuals started out in this way with a dream, with a hypnotic session or a psychic saying something, or having an emotional breakdown on a battlefield, and a couple of cases, all kinds of clues that were then able to unravel the threads, as it were, of things in the current life that seem to hook up with the previous lifetime. So the website encourages people to do that, and we have a Jungian analyst, Sabine Lucas in Santa Fe, who does dream analysis, and she goes beyond that then, using the empirical validation, or a better word is corroboration. Validation means that we've proven it, but it's better to say corroboration.
Is there at any point, Paul, with anyone you've talked to about reincarnation, does anybody say that we do not have free choice in the matter?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are a number of people who say, well, this is all just part of the, the plan for us, it's predetermined, predestined that we're going to follow this sort of pattern and so on. I see that as sort of a theological set of assumptions. There's no way, once again, that we can prove it or not prove it. I would say the evidence suggests in an evolving universe, in a self-learning universe, that it would not be possible to have this sort of preordination or predestination of everything and still have learning, because learning requires free will. Learning requires what we call in philosophy degrees of freedom of choice.
So
in other words, that we have to be able to make some choices in order to learn. We have to make mistakes, and to make mistakes, and you have to have accidents, you know. So
that's how you learn.
That's how you learn. And so that, for me, that's sort of what I see as the self-learning natural model of the universe that we're in, and that reincarnation is a part of that. Now, obviously, there are influences. All of us live within the parameters of this universe, so we're not totally free agents. I mean, the laws of nature, the laws of consciousness, the laws of society, involvement with itself and with other societies, all of these things are forces that impinge on us, but within those external forces, there is that degree of freedom, which I think is there, and makes reincarnation an integral part of it.
Well, it's something that you've believed in a long time, and I have too. What about, of course, and I'm saving this one toward the end, and next hour we'll take calls with you, karma. How much does karma factor into this? The person, the kind of, if you're a good person, are you going to be a good person in another life? Or does an evil person become good and a good become evil? Which I don't believe is the case. I think you keep getting better.
Well, I think the progress is one of progress. it has its ups and downs. It has
two steps forward, one step back at all?
Exactly. Now, but see, karma is one of those sort of philosophical terms which has gotten away from its original meaning. In the early Sanskrit, in the Vedic concept of karma, it was just simply the action resulting in a cause or an effect. So you have a cause and effect relationship. And I think that is what applies in reincarnation. If we have had a difficult time in a previous lifetime, and we have not psychologically, emotionally resolved those issues that we met in that previous lifetime, we're still going to have them as challenges in this lifetime. And this is where a lot of the regression therapy is helpful, because if people are able to tap into that previous lifetime and its traumatic experience, you have what Freud called a cathartic release of this repressed emotional energy.
Paul, should we all get regression hypnosis? Let's talk about that when we come back. We'll open up the phone lines. You'll take your questions, and also perhaps you have a reincarnation story. I'll be back.